I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from San Luis Obispo. We're here with Jim Gregory. And Jim is the author of a brand new book just coming off the presses called Patriot Graves, Discovering a California Town's Civil War Heritage. And specifically, that town is Rio Grande, California.
It's a town where I grew up and where I finished my high school teaching career. I taught at Rio Grande High School, which was my alma mater.
And then you also taught at Mission College Prep?
Taught at Mission Prep for 11 years, 30 years total, and retired in June of 2015. So I decided, in an effort to keep myself out of trouble and off the streets, to start writing history books.
You obviously have a passion for local history, which is Rio Grande, and then dovetailing with your total fascination with the Civil War and Civil War veterans who came out here.
There's always been, and this exists in teaching too, and it's something I tried to bridge, kind of a disconnect between local history and national history. I think our kids are done a disservice. Whenever I could, even when I taught European history, if I could bring local history and make some kind of connection, I did. So that's been kind of the mission for the two books I've written, one on World War II and this one on the Civil War, is to bridge that gap. And obviously, the biggest crisis in Rio Grande during the years of the Civil War was the drought of 1862-63. But after the war, I would come to find out that the total eventually reached 52 Union veterans, 51 soldiers and one nurse who came and settled in Rio Grande. So I became determined to find out where they had served, what battles they had fought in, and then why they had come and settled in my hometown after the war.
And did you discover this by walking through graveyards?
Actually, graveyards are one of my favorite places to do research. The World War II book started by me finding the tombstone of a young Marine, and from the date of his death, March 1st, 1945, I realized that he had to have died on Iwo Jima. So that was really what started the ball rolling for the World War II book. For the Civil War book, we have a Medal of Honor winner, Otis W. Smith, who's obviously the most prominent of the Civil War generation. But I began wandering among the tombstones and writing down. Our forefathers had the foresight with Civil War veterans to list their regiment and even their company. So that was the springboard. From there, I was able to go to National Park Service, Ancestry.com, look up their dates of service, and then trace these veterans to various battlefields, from Antietam to Gettysburg to Missionary Ridge to Appomattox.
Your research dug deeper because you wound up having conversations with some of these guys. You heard their voices.
Yeah, one of the biggest finds was through a man named Jack English, who is an Rio Grande resident, whose ancestor, Erastus Fouch, fought with an Ohio regiment in the Civil War. Jack has his great-great-grandfather's Civil War diaries, and they are incredible. He joins in Ohio at the age of 16, probably fibbed about his age. He joins with an older brother who is 18 years old. They leave Ohio to see the big world. They wind up in the Shenandoah Valley under the command of John C. Fremont, who was, of course, a notable in San Luis Obispo history. In fact, in 1848, Fremont camped on a site that was no more than 2 miles from the place where Erastus Fouch would homestead after the Civil War. The most moving part of the diary, the wonderful descriptions of camp life, of food, of the weaponry. They were issued Enfield rifles, British manufacturers. But the most moving part is on a day in Shenandoah Valley. It's a battle that's not important in the great scheme of things, called McDowell. But his regiment runs up against Stonewall Jackson's forces. And after kind of a desultory 2-hour artillery barrage by Fremont, the infantry is set in. And they begin a firefight at the distance of about 200 yards. And this is when we're still using Napoleonic tactics, but the weapons have improved exponentially. And at some point, Erastus looks around. He doesn't see his brother. And he doesn't find out until they're driven from the field by Jackson's forces. But he puts it very succinctly in his journals. My brother Leonidas fell to rise no more. Never mentions his brother again in the diaries for the rest of the war. He eventually will wind up fighting at Chancellorsville. He'll be captured on the first day of Gettysburg and paroled. Ends his war in Florida, of all places. And then in 1880s, moves to San Luis Obispo County and begins farming in the upper Rio Grande Valley.
There's a backstory there that when the Civil War concluded, 1865, these guys went home to a different world where they felt a stranger in a strange land. Tell us about that disconnect and what motivated them to leave their hometown.
One of the real catalysts for writing this book and for focusing on Union soldiers is a wonderful book by a young Yale historian called Marching Home. And this book reveals that these young men had a terrible time adjusting to post-war life. One example, and it's a minor one, but it's significant. Soldiers who had spent 2 years fighting in Georgia or Mississippi and who went back home to Iowa or Minnesota couldn't stand the winters anymore. Other soldiers, since most of these regiments were recruited from counties or even little towns, they might go home and find that they were among the only young men who had survived the war. In other cases, soldiers at the end of the war felt a profound sense of loss and depression, and they began to get into trouble. Two-thirds of the inmates in American penitentiaries in 1880 were Civil War veterans. They had terrible struggle with alcoholism. There was a tremendous binge that resulted in a riot in Chicago during the mustering out summer of 1865. The young historian that I mentioned in Marching Home mentions one veteran who became so desperate he commits suicide by lying down on a railroad track and leaves a whiskey bottle next to the track as kind of a suicide note. Veterans were also subject to what we would now call PTSD, but of course there was no clinical name for what they were going through, and they mostly suffered alone. Oddly enough, even though the South was devastated, Southern veterans went home and they were largely received as conquering heroes, even though they had lost the war. There was the myth of the lost cause. Psychologically, Southern veterans in many ways fared far better than Northern veterans. Northerners wanted to put the war behind them. We were now in the Gilded Age. We were in the age of getting ahead, Horatio Alger, industrialization, the expansion of the West. And the Civil War was something that people really wanted to put behind in their memories.
So talk to us about the motivation for going out West and coming to places like Oro Grande.
These men wanted a fresh start, and of the 52 veterans, I followed census records for about a third of them and found out that seven had moved from their home state, the state they'd served in the war once. Seven had moved at least twice, and nine had moved three or more times. Erastus Fouch, for example, lived in Minnesota before he finally came to California. So there was, a tremendous, first of all, of course, there was the opportunity. Land was relatively cheap. But then there was the sense of wanting to leave the past behind and start over again. And I think, in a way, that was an extremely constructive thing for them to do. So many of the veterans would lapse into criminality or into drug addiction or into alcoholism.
Shades of Iraq, Afghanistan
exactly.
Veterans.
It was horrific. You take Erastus Fouch, who lost his brother in combat. Erastus Fouch would come to Oro Grande and would be one of the principal motivators in the 1896 founding of Oro Grande High School. And I have to think that losing his brother and wanting to do something for young people was something that motivated Mr. Fouch. Another example would be Charles Clark, who was a Union cavalryman during the Appomattox campaign, becomes the town's baby doctor, for crying out loud. Most of these men were farmers, but they all seemed to have a pretty healthy life and raise big families, you know, a lot of 7 to 9 to 11 kids. And the other thing I think that's unique about Oro Grande, because I've always loved my hometown, is that the GAR, the Grand Army of the Republic chapter here, was very active.
When did it start? And yeah, it must have been huge.
Right. It originally starts in 1868. The Oro Grande, the Colonel Harper chapter, started in the 1880s here. But the old IOOF hall, which is on Bridge Street, was the GAR headquarters. And they used to call it Decoration Day, Memorial Day, the old veterans would stage a parade from the IOOF hall to the cemetery where there would be recitations of poetry and songs. And there are some wonderful pictures of them, these men with these silky white beards, and they're always accompanied by schoolgirls and schoolboys and the town band. And then they would march back to the IOOF hall and have a huge chicken dinner. So the county-wide chapter of the GAR was founded at the Methodist campground, which is behind Oro Grande. So looking at the old newspapers, these meetings, they were called campgrounds. They were held in Oro Grande. They were held at Pismo Beach. They were held at Sycamore Springs and Avila. They always got big coverage in the newspapers. And unlike many veterans, I think that Oro Grande and San Luis Obispo County went out of their way to recognize and respect Civil War veterans.
And I think it's interesting because, like we talked about, it was not immediate. It took 20, 30 years. It was the 1880s, 1890s, when people really got it, with shades of Vietnam 20, 30 years later. And I think part of it is the veterans were in the waning days of their lives, and they really understood that mortality and the preciousness of their time.
I would work from the time of their enlistment, use records to find out where they, served. But I also worked backward from old newspapers and starting with their obituaries. And the obituaries go into great detail about where they served, what they did, what they saw. You know, extremely respectful, this beautiful, flowery Victorian language that they wrote in those days. But again, it's indicative of what you're saying. The first veteran of the generation to die is named Thomas Whiteley, who was born actually in England. He was a bootmaker. He dies in 1898, and the account of his funeral is extremely moving. And I follow these veterans through these obituaries, and they're all indicative of the recognition that this generation that's passing is kind of a national treasure, and we'll never see their like again.
I'm Tom Wilmer. We're talking with Jim Gregory from Rio Grande, California, the author of Patriot Graves, Discovering a California Town Civil War Heritage. Tell us a bit more about the relationships that you established in your mind with some of these veterans, you know, how they came alive to you.
It's similar to the experience I had in writing a World War II book. These young men and women I wrote about in World War II, Rio Grande, or my father's generation. In many ways, they became like my own sons. I have two sons in their 20s, so it's not a stretch for me to have that same kind of relationship with people from 150 years ago. In particular, one example, Bella Clinton Ide is the guy's name. He will eventually become a Rio Grande's postmaster, a job his son will inherit. His obituary reads that he was the friend of every man, woman, and child. He sounded like a very gentle soul. His house is the oldest extant house in Rio Grande, built around 1880 on a street named for him. There are three streets named for Civil War veterans in Rio Grande.
And they are?
They are Ide Street, Whiteley Street, and Bakeman Street. And Bakeman fought at Shiloh, Fort Donelson. Whiteley was a town bootmaker. Bella Clinton Ide intrigues me because he belonged to one of the most famous Civil War units, the Iron Brigade, specifically the 24th Michigan. These were men who affected their headgear. They wore the broad-brimmed black 1855 issue Union Army hat, and they were known as being some of the toughest hombres in the Army of the Potomac. On the first day of Gettysburg, when Henry Heath's Confederates are pushing back John Buford's cavalry outskirts of town, the 24th Michigan goes into action. They stampede an Alabama brigade, capture 200 Alabamians, and then retreat to a firing line. They've got an Indiana regiment on one side of them. They're confronted by the 26th North Carolina, which is a rarity in the Civil War. They are at full strength. The regiment theoretically had 1,000 men. The 26th North Carolina had 843. Bella Clinton Ide's regiment, 496, which is pretty typical for mid-Civil War.
Attrition rate.
Exactly. And they weren't replaced. So the 26th North Carolina crosses Willoughby's Run, a little creek, and the two sides start firing at each other at 40 yards. And in a 20-minute firefight, 363 of the 24th Michigan's 496 men are killed or wounded. They'll eventually pull back to the Cemetery Ridge, where the Lee will try to dislodge the Union forces. But to go through something like that and to turn out the way Bella Clinton I did is evidently such a warm and gentle person, bespeaks the quality of the veterans who would make their homes in Rio Grande. He was evidently an extraordinary man. And the things they saw, George Monroe, 148th Ohio, was stationed at City Point, Virginia, which was Grant's headquarters and ammunition depot, which a Confederate agent tried to blow up while Monroe was there. He heard Abraham Lincoln speak. Lincoln gave his regiment a farewell as they were being mustered out and thanking them for their service. James Dowell, and I taught one of his descendants, a wonderful young woman named Joanna, when I taught at Mission Prep. Family very prominent in Nipomo. His son would be a judge. He fought in a Kansas cavalry unit. One of the chapters deals with the Indian Wars that were going on contemporaneous with the Civil War. His commander was a guy named Connor, who was determined to kill every hostile in the Powder River region over the age of 12. Didn't work out that way. His cavalry column promptly got lost, managed to camp out at a midway point, between the camp of Sitting Bull and Roman Nose were attacked by Sitting Bull's people, the author says, who fell on them like angry badgers. The only thing that saved them is that the temperature dropped 70 degrees in a 24-hour period. A blizzard hit, and the Indians went home. In the following week, they were attacked by Cheyenne, led by Roman Nose, but there was a young Sioux warrior out there that day, too. They formed the wagons in a hollow square, not a circle, and this young fella runs along the firing line, daring them to come out and get him. They fired away at him, missing, because he was wearing medicine. He had a little stone tied behind one ear. And it turns out that what James Dowell of Napoleon, California, saw was a ride by Crazy Horse, which is something that, you know, most Western historians would give a right arm to have seen. Anyway, the Powder River Expedition was a complete fiasco. One of the oldest homes in Rio Grande was built by John S. Rice, a man who saw the largest mass execution in American history. And that's the hanging of 38 Santee Sioux in Mankato, Minnesota, in 1862. So, you know, our little town has connections to these epic, in many cases, extremely tragic events from American history. And the book is intended to kind of make that connection, to bridge that gap.
Tell us about the book. There's some fascinating photos, and there's a chronology that follows the Civil War and the characters.
Yeah, the book is basically, I try to open it by discussing the post-war period, the trials that veterans went through in adjusting to coming home. And then I decided to start the book at a low point, and that was the battles of Antietam and Chancellorsville. Antietam, dreadful battle, still the largest single-day amount of casualties in American military history. And then Chancellorsville, in which the Union Army was humiliated by a brilliant flanking movement by Stonewall Jackson. So I started at the deepest, darkest point. Then I kind of moved theater by theater. I knew a lot about the Civil War in the East. What I enjoyed in writing this book is how much I learned about Sherman's campaign, about the campaigns in Tennessee. And so we kind of take it theater by theater until we reach the end of the war, in which probably the largest number of veterans who settled in Rio Grande would participate in the Appomattox campaign. I chose to write about Union veterans for several reasons. One of my favorite historians growing up was a guy named Bruce Catton, and I grew up during the 100th anniversary of the Civil War when John F. Kennedy was our president. So it always fascinated me. Catton is a brilliant writer. One of the things I use in the book is the Union Army's addiction to coffee, which was an addiction my wife and I, both school teachers, share. We call it teacher fuel. And also the book Marching Home, about the trauma that Union veterans in particular faced after the war. And I have to say, I'm named for two Confederates. My great-great-grandfather was a brigadier general. My first name is James. His son, my middle name is Douglas, was a staff officer who was killed in Pea Ridge in Arkansas. And I think I wrote it just to irritate them. I've done some family research, and to go back in my family background and to find my third great-grandfather, his name was Godfrey, in the 1850 census, to find his name, his family's name, and to find 19 slaves who are listed only by gender and age. They're not even given the dignity of a name. That rankles. And so in my way of thinking, the Civil War was what the Catholic Church calls a just war, because it did end in the eradication of slavery, which was, to my way of thinking, one of the darkest stains on our earliest history. So the book was written in part just to irritate my ancestors. If you look at the ordinances for secession, South Carolina, for example, condemned states' rights because states' rights was a justification northern states were using for harboring runaway slaves. Slaves were the rungs of the ladder to making it in the South. And I think that if you look at the ordinances of secession from, and I looked at seven, Texas, South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, they all explicitly cite the defense and even the expansion of slavery as a justification for civil war.
Interesting, and, because that's denied by many people in the South today.
Yeah, I think that states' rights, like the mythology of the Lost Cause, is just that. It's mythology. And I know that's going to upset some people, but
But it was a fact. It was an operative. I mean, you can read Senate testimony about that issue. Anyway, we have a whole other show here. So dovetailing back, my question in my mind started, did any Civil War veterans from the South come out to Rio Grande, come out to the West.
That's what really frustrates me. I know there are Civil War veterans buried in the San Luis Obispo Cemetery. They even have their own distinct headstones. It's similar to, but there's it has a more pyramidal shape at the top.
So it doesn't say Confederate CSA.
It should say their state and their unit.
But it won't say CSA.
Right. I could not find any of those in the Rio Grande Cemetery. There are a couple of reasons for that. It looks as if the Grand Army of the Republic, the Veterans Organization, was very meticulous in documenting where people were. The records are excellent for Union veterans. We have a Confederate organization, but I think it's in Santa Barbara. But again, the impetus for focusing on Union soldiers, quite honestly, they were easier to find. Again, there's 52 of them that were recorded buried in Rio Grande. Secondly, it was this book, the young historian's name, a Yale historian, Brian Matthew Jordan, and the book's called Marching Home, and it's about the terrible time Union veterans in particular had adjusting to life after the Civil War. So that was the thing that really led me to the focus on Northerners, that book. It was, for me, a life-changing book.
One thing I'm blank on is the interrelationship and friendships that were developed post-Civil War between the South and the North.
You know, one of the most moving pictures, photographs I've ever seen is on the 1913 anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. You see the stone wall that was the objective by the Copse of Trees for Pickett's division. 12,500 men go up, half of them come back. And there are old veterans from a Philadelphia regiment, and the survivors of Pickett's charge are reaching across the stone fence to shake their hands. That's not the whole story. They don't tell you that there was a fist fight at Gettysburg that sent at least 7 Yankees and Confederates to the hospital. They don't tell you that many of these veterans would, as Jim Crow laws, as the Ku Klux Klan rose, were incredibly resentful of the South. They had felt that what they had fought for was being lost in the Reconstruction years. They protested vehemently when a statue of Robert E. Lee was placed in the Statuary Hall in the Capitol building.
This is, again, 1911, 1912?
Yeah. They were outraged at D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which President Woodrow Wilson, who was raised in Georgia, something like, this is history writ with lightning, and it's all so true. Well, the veterans groups beg to differ with that portrayal. So as much as I love the idea of reconciliation, the last Gettysburg reunion, which was during FDR's administration, even as advanced in age as these guys were, they were very careful to separate the Union and Confederate camps by several miles.
Wow. Till their dying day.
In fact, my father grew up in a Texas County, Missouri, in the Ozark Plateau. And as you know, Missouri was a divided state. In the town, there were 2 Civil War survivors. One had been a Confederate cavalryman. The other one had been a Yankee drummer boy. And for 60 years after the end of the Civil War, these 2 men refused. We're talking about a town of 800 people. They refused to talk to each other. If one saw the other walking down the street, he crossed the street to the other side. If one wanted a haircut or a shave and the other was sitting in a barber chair, he'd turn around and get his haircut or a shave another day. Okay, it's about 1930. It's the 4th of July, or as we call it in Missouri, the 4th of July. And you got to imagine it's a park downtown. Missourians know how to eat. There's fried chicken. There's fruit salad. There's, you know, every different kind of pie you can imagine. And the town band makes the mistake of opening the festivities with the Star Spangled Banner. The old Confederate snaps. He goes after the Yankee drummer boy. So they're rolling around in the dirt and the grass and the potato salad.
How old are they?
They're in their 80s, okay? And the Confederate is trying to kill the Yankee. It takes about 7 young, strong men to pry this old geezer off the Yankee. When they pry him off, he's holding the guy's ear. He sliced off his ear with a Barlow knife. And he says, "I finally got you," as the sheriff takes him off to jail. He was jubilant. He'd finally got even. So this is 60
this
years.
Is, yeah, the 1930s.
This is about 1930s. So these old foes remained old foes till the ends of their life. So that's extraordinary, too.
Well, you know what, Jim? We're going to come back and do part 2 of Jim Gregory Tales, and I'd love to do a piece on your World War II book.
There's some very moving stories there, and some stories of both battlefield courage and my favorite kind, moral courage.
Something we all question. Do we have it?
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Jim, thank you very, very much. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Jim Gregory, the author of Patriot Graves, Discovering a California Town Civil War Heritage. To learn more about Jim Gregory, website for your book and for you?
Go to Amazon.com. You can learn more about my World War II book, which is simply World War II of Rio Grande. I also have a blog. The information for the blog and the upcoming book should be on Amazon.com.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Jim Gregory, the author of Patriot Graves, Discovering a California Town Civil War Heritage.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting from Knoxville, Tennessee, Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Steve Cook contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.